Welcome to episode 30 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
Okay. Today we are...
February 27th.
On February...
Saturday.
Yep. 27th.
Yep.
And we are... taping this a little later than expected, but...
which we did a lot later last time, so I know. Not too bad.
Hopefully it's not a trend.
Yeah. And well, no, it's gotten better.
It has.
Yep.
It has. So we can get started with the blog entries. How about you start with your blog entry?
No.
No.
Because we have a whole new system. First of all, administrative stuff.
Do okay.
Do we have anything? I don't think so, actually.
No.
Okay. I had it on my list, so just wanted to make sure. No, you remember last time, we were like, it works a lot better if we go by topic.
Got it.
Okay. So I was thinking wherever they fit in. Your blog entry will be the gravitational waves?
Yes, it is.
And mine's going to be about buildings, so we'll do yours now, actually.
Okay. So we both got very excited about the recent... The recent discovery of being able to detect gravitational waves.
Actually, before we do, there is one administrative thing to do. The website is fully up to date, finally.
Yeah.
We're kind of holding off, and all your blogs are up, all my blogs are up, and our latest podcast is up, including the show notes, the last one.
Awesome.
So, yep, just nice. Wanted to like... Yep. You know. Anyway, so go ahead. Gravitational waves.
Gravitational waves. And so we have this wonderful discovery that came from the LIGOS observatory system. And it's just a fun story to think, you know, we have Einstein that came up with this whole theory of gravitational waves 100 years before this discovery. And the discovery comes before the observatory system is up and running. So it's a pretty cool story where they have a wonderful system that they've thought out and they put into place at the observatory. The LIGOS system has false positives injected into the system to test the software of the system, the telescopes, and the observer.
Yep.
And I just...
We talked about this a lot last time.
We did.
So much that I named our podcast episode.
Right. So we've talked a lot about this before. The blog is very short. The links at the bottom are my favorite links about the topic. Uh-huh. And they're both out of Science and written by... Adrian Cho.
Yeah.
Very nice work.
I love that you picked the picture of, I can't remember the guy's name that first saw the waves. You know, it's not like it's his discovery.
Drago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marco Drago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Marco Drago. It's not that it's his discovery. It's just that he had the adventure.
Right.
It's fun.
It's fun. Know? And he looks... very low-key in the picture. It's not something that he's like showboating, hey, I'm here.
Yeah.
I am the one. And so it's just, I love the story. And please, you know, pursue that topic because you'll have a lot of fun. It's a great read.
Moving on to, I'm thinking... staying with physics and astronomy, we'll do James Webb.
Sounds great.
I think this is going to be the title of this podcast.
Wonderful article.
So we're going to talk about the James Webb Space Telescope. It's from, let me see, the article. It was like a news piece.
Yes.
Out of the February 19th Science.
Right. It's written by Daniel Clary.
Did you want to do it, or do
I'll
you
start?
Want?
Okay. Okay, so we have the James Webb Space Telescope. It's a telescope that's been in the planning for a long time, and it actually they actually started the planning for it in the late 1990s. And it is...
I think it was pretty much as soon as Hubble got corrected, they were like,
right.
Right. Yeah. Now what do we want? Our next thing.
And so right after they fixed the Hubble, then they were right on to the James Webb Telescope. It is one of the most expensive projects that NASA has had so far. And it is just an incredible engineering feat as you think of all the different components that have to come together and work. And it's right down to the materials used for the engineering and design of the product, as well as just integrating all those systems together.
Yeah, I think it's the engineering feat is huge, and the science is going to be huge.
Yes.
It's going to get at that infrared region that we can't see right now.
Exactly.
Which, I mean, they had a bit about, you know, that in exoplanets, there's some chemical signals that really you can only analyze using the infrared spectrum. But the really big one seems to be cutting through the dusk in our own galaxy and seeing places which you just can't see before. Couldn't see before, so
right.
And also earlier time in that I know a lot less about, but it seems like it would be huge for science, because you get more redshifted as stuff goes further back.
Mm-hmm.
We should. Am I right about this? That we should be able to see. We kind of see closer, you know, all the way back to when the universe became transparent, but maybe not quite. And with this, we might be able to see that far back from the furthest sources.
Right.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure of that, but one of the things that I found fascinating as I was going through it is just seeing the engineers at work on the telescope. And, you know, it's one thing to read about the size and how they, oh my goodness, they had to cut down the sun's heat dissipators or whatever they're called.
Yep.
And then to see that they cut down the size, and then you see two people working on it, and
It's
so huge that it's like, whoa, I thought I had it, but I really don't, I can't really vision the whole thing together. And I also, you know, just,
you know what,
thinking
I was
about, like, the heat that they had to be aware of, and the heat dissipation that they had to provide so that the telescope didn't overheat. It's just to think of that materially when you're designing is, I think, an incredible feat in itself.
Yeah. But yeah. Right. Because the heat, the important thing there is, so they're going down to 40 Kelvin. Is that right?
Yeah.
I think that the point about the heat is because you're in the infrared, then, I mean, it's not like it's going to be close to the sun.
Right.
You know, not any closer to Earth. But because you're measuring in the infrared, just the heat of the telescope itself will tend to cause noise in the detectors.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, well, did you have something else?
Yeah, and so, and then you start to think about the grinding process for, and it's like, you know, any one of these things, if you were given enough time, you would start to think, wow, this is really complicated on its own.
Yeah.
But then as you read the article, you start to see the layered effect. Okay, we chose beryllium after testing many substances because it was had the best results over the tests that we did in these particular heat range. And then,
well, I think it was specifically that
it was,
it would come back to form better than glass.
Right. Right. And it was strong and light because it has, they also have to be mindful of the mass of the overall structure. And then you think of the grinding and the, and yeah, they could have done.
Down to nanometers.
Yes. And they could have, you know, kind of cut back on the panels that they would be using, the view panels on the web. But by doing that, or, they would have also reduced the clarity of their image. And so there's always this kind of...
Well, they did have to cut back some.
They did. But
they're,
it's like...
They're going less precise than they had originally planned.
Right, they did. Yeah. But, you know, it's like, how many decisions like that have gone into this project? And, you know, it's just like when we're building things for the first time.
Yeah.
And we're building technology and putting technology together for the first time in these ways, that there's so many decisions that have to be made. And then we have to balance, okay, so how much are we willing to give here on the clarity? How much, you know?
So maybe, I mean, we should mention exactly what it was, because this is kind of a techie thing.
Right, it is.
It's a cost-saving thing, right?
Yes, it is.
It turns out that it's... The way I understand it, it's really going to affect, it's going to make it not as precise in the shorter infrared wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
And the key there is that those are the infrared wavelengths that we don't get too blurred or that can still make it through the atmosphere. So ground-based telescopes can get that, and Hubble can get that because it's not too far into the infrared. Well, I don't know about Hubble, but definitely ground-based telescopes can see into those infrared where we'll lose precision. I don't know why. Well, yeah, it makes sense. Slightly less precise grinding, longer wavelengths should be affected less. So it makes sense.
Yeah. Right. But then still, it's just going to make it 1 to 2 micrometers. Loss to what the ground-based telescopes are.
Well, 1 to 2 micrometers is the wavelengths of light. So 1,000 to 2,000. It's still, you know, into the infrared.
Right, it is.
But infrared goes very far. I don't know when you stop considering it infrared.
Yeah.
Probably 5,000 nanometers is still infrared. I don't know.
Right.
10,000.
So.
Anyway. So I had another two things about this that really struck me. One was last night we were watching for our Friday movie, The Earth to the Moon. And one of the episodes we were watching over dinner was the one this they called Spider.
Yeah,
where the Grumman is making the LEM.
Right.
And this article about Hubble. I'd say about more than half of it is about all the testing they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings together a second part of what I love about this. Unlike Hubble and many things we put up into orbit, this has got to go to the L2 point, which is one of those semi-stable points where you park something out there and it will tend to not drift away because of gravitational forces.
Right.
And it's directly away from the Earth by, I don't know, like 1.5 million kilometers or something. I might have that totally wrong. I think it's around there. It's similar to the Lagrange points where you have these, like I always remember the ones around Jupiter. You have Jupiter and then you have a bunch of asteroids that are, I don't know how many, like 40 or 60 degrees away from it, from around the sun, and they just kind of sit there because it's stable. And there's another couple points like that. So it's going to be sent out there to get away from everything that can cause noise, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so far away, there's no way to fix it once it gets out there.
Right.
Right. So that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a huge gamble.
It's
one of the biggest cost missions in I don't know how long for NASA, and if anything doesn't work, we're screwed.
Right.
There's no way to fix it like there was to Hubble. Mm-hmm. So that brings it back to the first thing that is kind of cool about this article. They go through all this testing. They're transporting different parts, different places in the States to have this testing. They have it in this huge chamber where they're cooling it down and heating it and cooling it and mm-hmm. putting it through lots of vibration.
Right.
And it's a little bit like with Spider in the Earth Through the Moon series that Tom Hanks was presenting, that where for the lamp they were doing all this testing because you're going to put it in space and you're going to put people in there.
Yes.
And there's no way to rescue them apart from what they can do.
Right.
So they did all this testing and sometimes stuff would fail. And then it goes up there and you hope you've tested everything that you can. And it's all new technology. Mm-hmm. And James Webb, it's the same thing.
It is.
It's all new technology. You're going to put it out there. It's so expensive. You can't afford to have it fail. But, you know, it might.
Right.
So you do all of this huge amounts of the expense. It's just testing it on Earth.
Right.
And they had the detectors, I think, that they already had built and everything, and they mm-hmm. put through the vibration and little flaps that control whether the light gets to it or not started to jam.
Right.
So they had to change all of those. And some of the silicon in the detector would crack. Mm-hmm. So that was not the vibration. I think yeah. that was the heating and cooling
it
cycles.
It was the heating and cooling cycles.
So they had to redo those.
Right. And yeah, and, you know, even the budget, you know, being so much over budget, yeah. I thought of that conversation where, you know, there's this one part
from the spider movie,
episode yeah. where the guy's sitting there and he's like, yeah, like, you
Do
know.
Do you remember when it was going to cost only 500 mil or when it was only going to cost $1 billion or something? It's like, I don't even remember.
Yeah. And it wasn't even that part. Nope. It was the engineers all sitting together at the desk and they're like, well, NASA called again and we're over budget and they need to know when this is going
to
be done.
Oh, they need to know if we can meet the deadline.
If we can meet the deadline.
Right. Because they had to go up in one of the earlier Apollo missions.
Right. Right. Like, and then this one guy goes, guys, I can't even laugh about this.
No, yeah, I remember this. It's like, so, can we make it? He asked the first guy.
Yeah.
Yep, we can make it. And the other guy's like, okay, can you make it? He's like, yep. And some other guy, yep. Then he gets to the last guy, and the guy's looking down at his paper, looks up, looks down at the paper. I'm sorry. And then suddenly all of them burst out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I can make it. No, I didn't. It might be awfully difficult. We could really. Thank God for the one guy.
I know.
I mean, I don't know if that's the way it happened.
It's, right. But it was well done. But yeah, else I could think of is all of these things that are going into play for many groups that are working on this one project. And then to think of them having to load this project up. It has to be shipped down to the Panama Canal and then placed onto another space dock.
Back up a bit. Before you get to that.
Okay.
I'm a little bit confused. I know it's got the mirror has to go on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only going to be like a few centimeters of space.
Right, but some of the parts are just too huge.
So is that going to California?
Well, yeah. So it's going to California early next year.
And it's going to truck by somewhere else or different parts.
And then,
because they're assembling more and more of it and testing different parts in different places, right? And as it gets more assembled,
then it gets
too
much,
big for one mode of transportation.
Larger. And then when in the final stages, when it's ready for launch, it's too large to fit into a plane, so it has to go by ship down the California coast to the Panama Canal to French Guiana.
So it's gonna the last putting it together must end up in California somehow.
Right. And the whole thing.
A lot of the testing is in Houston.
Yes. Yeah. So it's like this is being transported around and then going down the coast and through Panama. I know I'd be like awake at night if I was working on this project. No, protect the project, you know.
Yeah, no kidding.
Just because storms, whatever, just, you know, crazy natural events.
Yeah, totally. You know? Yeah. So here's another thing that's huge about the expense. We need to have it be large enough to collect all of this light.
Right.
Especially in the infrared.
Right.
Even in the large, I mean, I assume. And because it needs to be that large, then, but also fit into a rocket, it's going to have to unfold. And so you have, not only does it have to work correctly like Hubble, but it, before it even gets to work, you have to have a whole mechanism for it to assemble itself
right.
in space. I mean, it's not really assembly, it's unfolding.
Right. And they can unfold, like, their...
Because this is going to be one of those, like, the Keck
right.
in Hawaii. It's going to be all these hexagons
right. and
that are adjustable each independently. So
right. And they can work independently from each other.
Yeah.
But still, they have to be able to do that. So... Interesting.
Oh, did you see the part where at some point they're even going to test the mirror, like with Hubble, they actually never tested the optics with the mirror.
And they did.
But for this, well, they haven't done it yet,
but
they're going
will.
To put lights on the ceiling in one of the testing facilities and actually have it unfurled and have all of the detectors pointing up as if it was staring at the universe. Kind of cool.
So you know, it would be fun to see some of the stages where it's being tested.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It would just be very exciting.
Yeah. And one of the places where it's being tested, where they're decreasing it, one of the parts of the test is putting in a vacuum, right?
Yeah.
And cooling. I think where that's happening, vacuum and vibration,
that's
is
Houston.
One of the places where they did tests, not the same tests, for the Apollo missions, for the capsules.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
Neat. So, wonderful article, but, you know, just...
Yeah, very cool.
Cool project.
Okay. I scanned through your stuff. I don't think you have any physics/astronomy type stuff. Except for gravitational waves, of course.
I don't think I do.
Okay. And you saw my thing. We don't have any chemistry.
Unless
you
don't.
Do. So, move on to... biology type stuff.
Okay. So I have a bunch of short biology.
Do you want to go with that?
Sure. So very cute. There's a tiny snail.
Oh, yeah,
That takes flight underwater. And if you put that into the search engine at the science site, you'll actually get to see a little video where it looks like a bee. The way it goes through the water. And it is microscopic, so it is something that you will only view with your naked eye as a dot in the water.
Right.
So, you know, and I guess the reason I included this in our podcast is just, you know, we know so little about the organisms in the ocean. And... Yeah. It's just an ongoing process of us finding...
The mode of locomotion that first reminded me of nudibranchs.
Yes.
Except it's so small.
Yes.
And then it makes me wonder, well, are there nudibranchs that small? I mean, I don't even know.
Well, that's why it just made me think about all these things in the water that, you know, we have yet to discover. But interesting and fun. It's a very short article. And the video is actually... pretty
very
cool.
Yeah. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. The other ones that I'll put together is a race to keep out an amphibian killing fungus out of the U.S. And it's one of the concerns for U.S. scientists is trying to keep this fungus out of the U.S. And the fungus so far is really impacting the world's biodiversity of salamanders. And so they're trying to restrict the number of salamanders being traded to the U.S. And, you know, it's one of those battles that you have with people who don't know, maybe just won't even think about this fungal infection and how it's impacting the population, because they're looking at cool colors in their tank instead of the bigger thing.
I didn't see that article, but when I read yours, I was very interested.
It was very short. It was another very short animal article. And I always think it's a really good point that as animal lovers and pet keepers, we should be considering where our pets came from and what possible things that we're bringing in with our pets if we're importing them from different countries.
I have three things that it made me think about. Mm-hmm. First of all, do you remember Jan Senishin that I worked with 2003?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Definitely.
He was really into salamanders.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Neat. He actually had some that he was growing up from larva.
Oh, wow.
And he used to go into the woods and search for them. It turns out that your article says United States has the world's largest biodiversity of salamanders. Actually, it turns out, right here in North Carolina, I think we are the center of biodiversity for salamanders.
So that's really interesting that you say that, because what they do is they have this salamander camp for high school students.
Oh, yeah.
And it's they take a group of students for a week. Uh-huh. They train them on how to collect salamanders and to do population studies or population data collections for them. And they go out and collect data for the week, and then they, you know, they're staying at a camp, so it's not all they do, but they do that and they learn about the study and why they do it and what's important. And I've had one of my students go back two students go back 2 years in a row, which is a big feat for high school students, because if you think about it, ninth grade year, you can probably get them to come to a camp. Uh-huh. 10th grade year is very challenging because they're starting to think of internships that are more in their area.
Right.
And also summer jobs to get their car, because that's when you get you're able to drive around more and that. And so there's a lot of, you know, social competitions competing against. And to think of these students going back 2 years in a row, both of them wanted to go into science. One of them got all excited about this type of work. Uh-huh. And so that's totally put them on the track of what they want to do through college and that. The other person just thought it was very important and saw the necessity. So it's neat that they're going to go on to a different area of science, but they will have this understanding of why biodiversity is important and how to go about these studies.
Cool.
In a hands-on, with their hands-on experience. So,
The other two things for the amphibians. Do you remember a few days ago we were talking about Cory Doctorow made at, I think it was Waterloo University, where he mentioned someone else's idea about, you know, how do you deal with biological surveillance for diseases and stuff? And he was like, you know, if you have many people doing the sensing, then this quorum or this distributed sensing fails really well in that it's hard to bring it down because there's so many different independent people. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, you know, this is the type of thing it would apply well to as an invasive species or an invasive disease. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have many sensors out there by different people doing their own thing. And so anyway, I thought that was a fun connection.
Yeah.
The other thing is it mentions the funguses, the fungi that cause this. There's the one that kills all the frogs, which has been known, and they mentioned that as being BSAL. Mm-hmm. I didn't recognize that. But this one is BD.
Right.
Or is it the other way around? sister species of BD. So I guess BD mm-hmm. is the one that's been before, and B-cell is the one
that's
for salamanders now. Yeah. But both of them cause the same disease, mm-hmm. Chytridiomycosis. I don't know if you remember this, but we talked about an article at length. I don't know if it was last year. But I think it was the year before. It was before, I think, we started the podcast, where someone had done some electron microscopy, I think, and then measured body fluids in some of these frogs and found that when it gets into the skin, the ion balance, because the skin is such a huge mechanism, like our kidneys, for controlling right. ion balance in the frog's body, mm-hmm. that the ion balance in the frogs was so far off that it caused heart failure.
Wow.
Which makes sense. You know, yeah. muscles need the right ion concentrations on both sides to either not go tetanic on one side mm-hmm. because they get depolarized, or go flaccid on the other side because they can't get depolarized.
Right.
So, yeah, so it reminded me of that. I don't know if that's still the theory. But
yeah, so I have two other articles that I think are pretty close together. Both are very short, and I just wanted to do a brief mention of them. Mm-hmm. So on February 15th in Nature and Biotechnology, there's an article about integrated tissue organ printing. So this is the first time they've been able to generate bone muscle cartilage in rats and mice, and it was so successful that they are setting up for human trials. Very cool fact about this. This is work being done at Winston-Salem in North Carolina. And
yeah.
this is a group that actually I've been following for the last 4 years. Isn't
that
cool?
Really? Cool.
Yeah. So this is a lab that I've heard about. They're supposed to be open to the public. You have to make arrangements.
Sure,
but
sure.
if you wanted to do a class visit, you could. And I've been meaning to set it up with this lab and go just because I've heard about their work. So every time that I get interested, I read up about it and what they're doing right now. And so it seems like, you know, between the TED Talks that the head researcher does on this and the articles that come up, they just keep on coming out.
I was like, oh, this is interesting and stuff, but they're probably so far away. And then I got to the end of your notes and I'm like, FDA... currently working with FDA to set up human trials.
Yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Probably for bone.
So here's the other one that leads into that, uh-huh. is the UK allows animal-human chimeras. And this is very interesting stuff. And this is where we start to think about human organs being grown in animals.
Yeah.
And the other reason this one caught my eye is because this is something that is being worked on at NC State University in our neighborhood. So.
Wow.
Yeah. So NC State's
farm. But the U.S. is not funding.
They are starting to work on it. That doesn't mean
the UK is going to allow it, but the U.S. is not funding such. You have in your notes, they're not funding.
Yeah, but I don't know how to explain it. Like, they are setting up for it. So uh-huh. maybe they're doing the preliminary.
Or getting independent funding. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, I know that part of their farm is set aside for this type of research or the setting up of this type of research.
Yeah. Connects to something we talked about a couple podcasts ago about using CRISPR to target many mm-hmm. viruses across the board and destroy them
right.
in animal tissues.
Yeah.
Because then you can make it safer to use those animals to mm-hmm. grow.
And I think that's why we're seeing more of these articles suddenly, because
there's a synergy between the two different types
right,
of research.
Yeah. There's the ease of being able to do it. And I thought these went really nicely into your article.
Well, just before that, I just want to say that we have to say, we have to mention, we already said CRISPR just now.
Yes, we did.
I think, I'm not certain, but I think the last podcast, we didn't mention CRISPR once.
And the Earth didn't stop.
And the Earth didn't stop.
Since we did ours mainly on geology. And
it was mostly a lot of geology. Okay, so you want me to go into, let's see, which one is it?
DNA pocket DNA sequencers.
You know, I was holding that off to technology, but we could do it now.
Well, that's why I did the two biotechnology things.
That's true. And it is very biology. Biology-ish. Biology-esque. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what is this? Pocket DNA sequencers. It's a news piece out of Science. February 19th. And most DNA sequencing, well, all DNA sequencing is basically depends on trying to match up bases on a piece of DNA with complementary bases and replicating it until you have enough and seeing what gets added on and measuring that. So pocket DNA sequences, the idea is really different, and up until now, they really haven't worked very well. But instead of expanding all this DNA, and as you expand it and looking what gets added on, instead of doing that, you take a single pore, the way I understand it, between two chambers, and you have DNA, you put it on one side, and then you put electric current, I guess. And as the DNA starts, as some DNA gets close to the pore and then starts to enter it, it interrupts the current. And as it threads its way through, you measure the current, and different bases as they go through have different effects on that current. And so as it goes through, so it sounds crazy, but I think one of these pocket DNA sequences has only a single pore? Is that even possible?
I don't know. So that was a question that
because
I had.
Because if you have several pores, how could you, then it's back to, you're back to an ensemble. So how would you, anyway. So
which would be.
It sounds like that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
But I'm not certain. Anyway, so they haven't really worked because it's hard to tell one base from the other just from the current. But they've gotten better and better. And because it's so difficult, only one company has taken on the challenge of trying to bring it to the market. It's, you know, look for the company name. It's based out of the UK. Let me see. Oxford Nanopore Technologies. And they just had a big success. They took it to the field. So I guess that means in Africa. During the Ebola epidemic, and did some sequencing there. Let's see. So what are, well, so I think the neat tech stuff about it is the fact that they had this program to let labs use it, and basically a whole bunch of labs have been trying to find different ways to make it more accurate, make it faster, and increase the throughput. Those are the three big things. One of the ones, let's see, I'm looking over here, some of the stuff they did. So the first one is, how do you get it to be more accurate? Okay, so before I go on, the name of the device is called the Minion.
My favorite
which is
name.
Kind of fun.
I just love it.
Yeah. So one lab, basically what they took is, they did this, they took some DNA and mixed it with an enzyme and that takes the DNA and turns it into a circular piece of DNA where they keep adding parts to it. And, or they, I guess they replicate it. And then when they have many, you get
which
a long piece.
Which I think is like PCR, isn't it?
Because
that's what PCR does, is it gives you more replications of what you have. so that it shows up more in the that's on the gels.
Right. PCR is a way to expand what you already have. When you have a mixture and you want a specific one expanded.
Right.
So you put in a primer that you know matches the part of the one you're interested in.
Exactly.
And then the whole thing gets expanded. You do many cycles. So, yeah. So then when they have this long chain, unlike PCR where it's many copies, it's one copy or one length of DNA that has many copies in sequence.
Right.
So that when it goes through the pore, so you read it through, and as usual, it's low accuracy. But then it starts to come through again.
Right.
And then again and again. And they've found that after so many reads, they can do a really good job in measuring. So that was one that was developed independently. You know. Go ahead.
And then I like how to make, to help make the nanopore data better, they combined it with the conventional sequences.
Well, that they have to do normally.
Right.
And when you do the circular DNA and then expansion before you put it in, the idea is maybe you can get away without combining it, right? Without looking it up on databases. Let's see. Another lab, what did they do? Yeah. So this other lab, let's see, is it out of University of Birmingham, this other one? I don't know the first one where it went. No, John Hopkins? I'm not sure. Anyway, but the technique is the idea that as it goes through the pore, the reason that it's a bit noisy is because the change in the one of the changes in the current going through is not just because of the base that happens to be going through the pore, but also there's an effect of the base that's upstream and the base of that's downstream.
Mm-hmm.
So as you look through the signal, you don't just test to see, does it match this one of four bases?
Right.
You see, well, what are the combinations of, I'm reading it between the lines here.
Right.
But what are the combinations of a base and one of four bases and the possibilities for one out of four upstream and downstream? And you look at the signal you're getting and you try to match it to that, and they got way more accurate in identifying bases coming in a row. Let's see.
I love that it was used in the field for the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. It would be amazing to have an outbreak happen. These people come with this device and be able to nail what it is so quickly.
They said they were doing it in 24 hours.
Right.
And they said that in order to be clinically useful, you kind of need to have it happen in 1 hour.
Right.
So that's what all these efforts are. Yeah. There's one other one that sounded really cool, where the DNA starts to go through, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of your problems is with throughput, right? Because you can only do one piece of DNA at a time.
Right.
From a different part of the article, an example is you take a sample of human blood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's only going to go through one piece of DNA at a time, and you might have an infection, but even with a bad infection, most of the DNA in the blood is going to be from your own cells that have busted open and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. So most of the DNA that's going to go through is going to actually be yours. And so they found this way that if you reverse the polarity on the two chambers, you can kick a piece of DNA out pretty fast. And they were finding that within 250 or so base pairs or something like that, or bases, not base pairs, they could tell, oh, wait a second, this is not the piece of DNA we're interested in, kick it out and start it again without doing any change in the sample or anything. So anyway, and then the last one is actually not part of this external program. It's just they have the new version of Minion. Or it's not a new version. It's a new machine they call Prometheon. And it incorporates 48 Minions all in a row. So you do all this stuff in parallel.
Right.
Which I guess is obviously the way it was going to go. once this works. But I really like this idea of allowing labs.
To,
you know, you can have a closed system where you're going to bring it to your market, or you can just have it open and let all people see what they can come up with. And to a certain extent, you lose the ability to patent some stuff, right? Or maybe you don't. I mean, maybe they have to sign all these agreements. But it's kind of neat that you have all these people working at it outside the company.
Right.
Try to find a way to make it.
So there's a group also working, the O'Grady team. They're able to pinpoint causes of a urinary tract infection in 4 hours.
Yeah, that was
cool. And so I thought that was pretty interesting because now they can prescribe the specific antibiotic that you need, not as broad a spectrum to cover whatever infection you have. I thought that might really help a lot of people.
They were able to do this, or is it?
Yeah. So, well, this particular one I don't, but I was, when you were talking earlier about, you know, things they had done to improve it, I had hopped down to where they were actually using it to detect, like, Ebola, and within, they were able to get readings in a matter of hours for RNA virus infections. So it was specific to RNA virus infections.
Okay.
And they were able to do it for corona, dengue, Ebola, chikungunya, and Zika.
Is that something they were able to do, or is that the plans?
Oh, no, sorry. Increasing efficiency. And they're increasing efficiency, but
I think they're working on it.
They're working on it. Yeah. So
that's
sorry,
an awful
I,
lot.
I misread the information. Yeah. I was misleading you, but it's so exciting to think that have a device that is able to help a team that goes out, like a group of health workers going out.
That's what's really cool.
And you think of outbreaks of food poisoning, that would be the same thing.
Especially in countries that have serious problems in maintaining healthcare.
Right.
And then you have an epidemic and you send in Médecins Sans Frontières and they take a bunch of these with them.
I just think it would give a team like Doctors Without Borders an opportunity to really help a group in a much faster using, you know, these techniques, these tools.
Yep.
So.
Moving on a bit.
Yep.
Do you have others in the biology, ecology, evolution type stuff that you want to?
I do want to mention one other one. I'm not going to go into it much because I also talked about a similar article. We went over it last week quite a bit. Where
mitochondria?
It's another mitochondrion article, and it's called Why Do Our Cell Power Plants Have Their Own DNA? And it was published by Laurel Harmers on February 18th, 2016 in Science News. Science Magazine. And it was a good article. It's similar. Many of the things are similar to what we talked about last time. The one thing that stood out in this article, which I thought was interesting, is, one of the powers of the mitochondria is it's able to control its own genes, and because it has a separate set of genes, it's able to control its own protein synthesis.
Yeah.
And so,
I don't know.
You know, I found that interesting. You're giving me, sure.
I mean, I didn't read the article, right? But I have your notes, and when I looked at this, I was like, I had this feeling like they were searching to make a theory work.
Okay.
I didn't see tons of evidence. I saw a lot of theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand what they're saying, but I don't know. I the evidence seems pretty thin for such a big theory.
So
the way I think about it is, So the mitochondrion actually has very few genes. Mm-hmm. Most of them are over in the nucleus.
Right.
And it seems like a lot of what they're saying is, you know, you've got these big protein complexes, and aha, you've kept those some genes that are involved in these complexes, or mostly they're involved in these complexes, in the mitochondrion to have this finer control. Mm-hmm. So you can control individual mitochondria, or rather have them control themselves. But I can see other mechanisms for mm-hmm. having individual mitochondria mm-hmm. Taking a signal that's being sent to the whole cell and trying to adapt to it. Generally, you think to yourself, why did they leave the mitochondrion? Because the nucleus is just a better place to control genes.
Right.
And why are there some that are left in the mitochondrion? And, you know, I think most people are like, well, it's because it's hard to transfer genes from the mitochondrion to the nucleus. Mm-hmm. Evolutionarily, you know, you got to basically replace it. I don't think genes actually move. Mm-hmm. I think you make a protein that then fits in where you used to have another one in the mitochondrion, and the one in the mitochondrion, that gene disappears because it's not being used anymore. So why are the ones that are left behind part of mostly these complexes? Because you have to change both, you have to replace both the function and the structure that fits into that complex. That's awfully hard to do both at the same time. Mm-hmm. And now they're saying, look, you can control individual mitochondrion. Well, yeah, but, you know, yeah. It'd be really tough to change these genes anyway.
Right.
Is it because teleologically the cell wants to have better control so it hasn't? Or is it just because it didn't have a choice?
Right.
And, you know, maybe they have a lot more evidence from this, but it seems like all they did is, like, had a program that goes through and analyzes what these genes do. And
then they made broad statements based on...
Yeah, but maybe it's more specific than that. I don't know. You know, yeah. I didn't get to see...
And there may be an article coming online soon.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to keep my eye
open for it. I'm going to keep my eye open for it, but I'm curious.
Yeah, the whole mitochondrion gene regulation thing is really interesting, and their idea is fascinating.
It is.
That you might have mitochondria using... I mean, there's two levels of control. There's control with molecules, second messengers, mm-hmm. that you have floating around in the cell. And you have genetic control, which is a lot slower. You know, you're talking about, if you have to change to your proteins, you're talking about stuff that's going to take at least 20 minutes to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to synthesize, if you have to synthesize it, I mean, the perfect example is aldosterone in the kidney. Mm-hmm. You get aldosterone gets secreted into the blood, and you might have changes in protein in the kidney that change the, you know, how you filter your urine. It's only going to happen after all this time of protein synthesis is had time to go by, but you have a hormone signal that changes second messenger. You can internalize channels or put them in the membrane or shut them down. That's going to happen within seconds. Mm-hmm. So the idea that mitochondria could control their own genes like that, one separately from the other. Did you see they said your notes, the stuff you copied had a really thing about tens to hundreds of thousands of mitochondria in cells? They must be talking about muscle cells there.
They have to be, because that would have...
I mean, I could see thousands, but the place hundreds where you of would thousands of mitochondria? They must be muscle cells. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, it's a really cool concept.
Yeah. Okay, your turn.
Okay, so we're up to 54 minutes in this podcast about, and you know, the two main articles that I was really excited for were the James Webb one and the nanopore, mm-hmm. which is more of a techie type thing.
Right.
And the other ones, I don't, there's some, just to go over some stuff that's I want to mention that's in the news that's neat. There's a lot about Neanderthal genes in humans.
Yes, yes. There's I didn't get to that at all, but I'm interested.
I think I'm going to say, but I'm going to mention it's out there if someone mm-hmm. wants to look for it. There's also not listed on the human genes in a Neanderthal archaic genome.
Yes,
You heard about that?
I did. Uh-huh. I read it very briefly, and I thought, I'm going to go back to that, but I didn't get back to it. It's one that I want to go back to because it's did not expect that, and it's kind of a neat finding.
There was the cockroach one.
Maybe I was just about to say, I think we should talk about
that. Okay, we'll do that one.
Because I'm yelling because I found a bug in the bathroom, and I'm like, and I'm trying to get it, and Pat, instead of like, you know, he's back. He's, you know, back at his desk, and he's like, "Hey, I have to tell you something about cockroaches when you're done."
Okay, so let's do cockroaches.
Okay.
Okay, so this is an article about insects and their exoskeletons and how they are designed in, well, not just exoskeletons, structural components, and how they're designed to withstand crushing and battering and so on. And there was three main, it's mostly about stuff they've done with cockroaches, but there's three different animals that were tested, cockroaches, bumblebees, and wasps.
Right.
And three different tests. The article, by the way,
they didn't try to force a bumblebee into a small space.
No, they did not. No, but what they did is crazier. I'll tell you in a bit.
Okay.
So you didn't see that, okay.
No.
Anyway, it's a news piece out of Science, February 12th. Is it Perspective or news piece? I think it's a Perspective. No, news piece. Okay. So the idea is, you know, why can you slam down on a cockroach, look under to see a squashed bug, and instead it just runs away, no problem. This one team wanted to see, and I guess there's videos of this, I haven't seen them, but I just want to look this up, where they tried to force them to go through narrower and narrower slits to see what they could get through, and they were videotaping them.
Right.
And they also lowered down weights onto different parts of their bodies more and more, and then left it to see if it would bounce back or not, and see how much it sounds like torture.
Yeah.
But anyway, the description is really cool of, you know, you have a slit that's just a few millimeters tall, and the cockroach goes up to it, sticks its antenna through, feels around, puts its head sideways, pushes it through, then puts its forelimbs through, and it's got these spines.
Yeah.
So even though it can't
like
use its limbs.
On the back of its arms.
On the side of its arms. So even
like
though it can't.
Like good gladiators.
Yeah. So even though it can't crawl anymore the way it normally does, like with using its feet, it starts to use these spines to pull its body through so that it squeezes in, and then with its hind legs, it splays them out and then pushes frantically. And the body, the plates that makes up the exoskeleton are flexible. And so they squish, and the places between the plates are elastic membranes. So the plates can start to overlap, and I guess all the insides deform, and they just make their way through.
Yeah.
So that's part of the design of the skeleton. The other two, the bumblebee and wasp, both it had to do with how the wing is formed and how they can withstand. I guess they're constantly hitting stuff as they fly around.
Haven't you ever been hit by a bumblebee?
Yeah.
Not bit. Like I've just
no, I have.
Banged into.
I have. I just didn't realize how often it happens that they just hit their wing.
Yeah.
And the wasps and the bumblebees have slightly different ways to handle this. I think the WASP, if I remember correctly, has a section about, I don't know if it's a third or two-thirds down the wing, that's a piece of elastic material or something, I can't remember exactly, so that when the wing hits something, it bends at that spot mm-hmm. and then snaps back. And the B, I think it's the veins mm-hmm. that form the structural parts of the wing
yeah.
all emanate from close to the body. So mm-hmm. it gets less and less rigid as you go further out.
Yeah.
So when they hit, the wings kind of bend and then snap back into place.
Oh, neat.
So the crazy one, I can't remember if they did this with the wasp or the bumblebee, but they took one and they put it onto this rotating, like a centrifuge type thing with his wing out so that it kept getting against something and hitting it. Quack, 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 quack. I guess they videotaped this to see what would happen with high-speed camera. And then they took the little wing, like with the wasp on there, or the bee, I can't remember, and they put a splint on it so it couldn't bend at that spot, and then went through, and within a few revolutions, the wing just got
just
shattered.
Off.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, it shattered because it couldn't bend to absorb.
Yeah.
But I think, why didn't you just immobilize the wasp and then have something rotate to hit the wing rather than just spin the insect?
Okay, here's the other
crazy
thing. As you were talking about the cockroach experiment,
yeah.
I had the whole, you know, this is something that we have to send to Gary Larson. He just needs to take it to the new level of drawing his little pictures and making it. And, you know, it just sounds like it's begging for that.
It does.
Oh, and I'll also note that we brought up the cockroach article after our biology, since we consider them a lower life form somehow. From having to battle with them, I guess. It's just funny that, you know.
One last thing to mention is that they actually, you know, a while back we covered some squishy robots that did the...
Oh, yeah.
You remember it?
Yeah.
They had a little reaction to causing a small explosion. It would
mm-hmm.
hop.
Yeah.
So they had a new idea with this. They're like, well, let's try to make a robot like this. And they got a robot that they designed. It's 75 millimeters tall. And it's got this collapsible exoskeleton. And I guess it can make it through tight spaces.
Nice.
By collapsing itself and still making it through. Not as much as a cockroach, but
right.
fraction-wise.
But using
the concept. And there's two places where that's interesting. You know, you send robots to other planets, you might need it to explore caves and stuff, or even on Earth, right? Cave exploration, where you might need it to squeeze through something. And the other is for in disasters where you're doing victim recovery and you mm-hmm. don't know if someone in a earthquake is stuck in a building and they need
exactly.
to go have a robot search and make it through. So that was kind of cool.
Neat.
I haven't seen the robot yet, but I want to check it out sometime.
Okay. So time to jump to future plans?
I think so. I had a few others, but they're not as big. Oh, no, one more. Linux
okay.
Voice.
Oh, sorry.
So this is moving on just to technology.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get to see this one at all?
I didn't. You mentioned it to me, but I did not look at it.
It's about a system to help kids get excited about coding, I guess,
mm-hmm.
Mostly in Python. It's from Linux Voice, let me see, issue 25 on
mm-hmm.
page 72. Let's see, written by Les Pounder. Anyway, so the idea is that some really young kids, they start off with Scratch,
mm-hmm.
which some people like that, I guess. I don't know.
Some kids like it at school.
Do they?
And other kids are like, just give me the programming, you know.
I've never had experience helping out kids with it, and I don't know anything about it.
It's a blocky code.
Yeah, and I've seen pictures of how it works.
And then they put together the blocks of it, and after they put together, they can see the code or even see the code as they're putting it together.
So I actually didn't look at this in a lot of depth, but the idea is when you move on kids to a little bit, there's only so much you can do with this type, the whole blocky code concept. Mm-hmm. And you want them to have more versatility. You want to move them to one that's it's basically text written. And part of the fun of the blocky code is that you have things that you move and stuff. So this guy set up a system where he combined a robot that you control with a Raspberry Pi, right? Mm-hmm. And you write Python code for it to go, but you set up a like a Sharpie on the robot, and you use a program to make art, like you can make stars in your program, and then you figure, and but you're doing the art by typing in commands, right? And then you can send the same stuff to the robot, and it'll draw your stuff on the ground as it moves around. So it's kind of a cute idea.
Yeah,
I didn't see any pictures of kids using it.
So neat.
I don't know. But
so, what's it called? Oh, dear. I just forgot the name of it. And it's this wonderful, Khan Academy. It's a website.
You've mentioned it before on our podcast.
And it is free. And it is a wonderful tool for learning computer programming. And they do a similar thing.
Oh.
So you start by learning how to draw, and you draw these images, and you're given like tasks to draw certain simple images. And then the kids can add to those images, and then they can publish what they did, and someone can go in and look at their code, take it and modify it.
Cool.
And it's, I thought it was a nice.
You'll have to show me.
Add on to that.
Some of the Khan Academy, because like I've heard about it and stuff, but I don't think I've ever been, or if I've been on their site, I've never gotten very far.
So
and I don't know where to go.
This fall I used it for over a month in Makerspace, where I just said nothing but the Khan Academy, or another program where you're programming, and you can use blocky code. There were a few kids that came in and they did blocky code, but all the kids by the end were on Khan Academy, and it wasn't because I was forcing them to go. They started to like Khan Academy because they could see it putting them in a different place for their understanding.
I remember,
and that was really nice for me to see.
I remember you getting on trying to figure it out before, and me trying to help it and just not getting it.
Right.
But somehow it really worked for the kids.
Right, it did. So the kids, they were like, okay, I see this. I see how it's going through. Two of them worked through both of the programming thing. One went through the whole computer programming thing at home. So, like, part at school and part at home. And I think he was doing it to keep ahead of everyone because he wanted to make sure he was always doing the next step.
Okay.
So, but they enjoyed it, and it kept them engaged enough to want to go to the next step.
Now that you know more, I really want you to show me where you've gone and stuff. I have two more things I want to talk about.
I didn't mean to.
One is super quick.
Okay.
It's this thing I found. So I find if I can type in a command, a lot of times I'll do that instead of click on something because it's faster. Of course, you have to know it ahead of time.
Right.
One of the things that I'm leery of using is removing files. And the reason is when you type a command in Bash, it goes into your history.
Right.
Now you have let's say you want to remove every file in the directory, right? It's pretty easy. RM space asterisk enter, boom, it's gone. And they're not just
the disasters
totally
that could happen.
One thing that's really neat about your history is you up arrow a couple times, and you up arrow once, it shows you your last command.
Yeah.
Up arrow a couple times shows you two. So you have even like medium complicated command, or not even simple commands. It's so easy to up arrow once, enter.
Right.
So it's really scary to put RM space star RM space anything, because you're so used to using up arrow enter practically on thinking. And what if you make a mistake and you up arrow and you forgot and the last thing was remove everything in this directory? So this is what I found. If you type in a space before a command, it just ignores the space. Right? So you put ls to list files, it lists the files. You type in space ls, it'll do the same thing. It'll just list the file. But if you put a space before your command, it never gets added to your bash history.
Right.
So I've been using rm to remove files this last week all the time. I'm in a directory already working. I do something to alter the files. I want to get rid of my backup. Space rm asterisk dot JPEG. Let's say I converted a bunch of JPEGs to PNGs. Boom. All of these files in a video are gone. But it's not in the history because I put a space at the beginning.
Okay.
So it's really a handy thing.
Good.
The other thing, we can kind of move on to future plans, maybe. Oops, sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm using your mouse by mistake. It's kind of, I can transition to that if you want.
Okay.
It's, we're working on getting our stuff ready for version 2 of our transmitters.
Right.
We did an experiment last weekend and probably this weekend. And as I've been putting the battery holders in, it's been a real pain because of, you know, you buy battery holders out there. This just drives me crazy. They don't have good systems, most of them, for screwing your battery holders into something to make it so that it's being held there. Well, batteries get in the, if you drill it, it gets in the way of the batteries and so on. Anyway, it's been a real pain. Found on the web a 3D model in OpenSCAD for battery holders. And I started to work with OpenSCAD again, and I was surprised after not having looked at OpenSCAD for a while, going back to it, I could figure out this person's code and alter it and stuff. It was really cool. So, I don't know. We may or we may not go down that route for future versions of our transmitter, but definitely. It's an option. I think the cost might be pretty high. We were looking at, remember we were looking at a local guy that prints them?
We haven't really looked into it totally, but I think it will be
expensive
to have something 3D printed.
Anyway.
No, agreed.
So maybe I still want to try for some brackets or something, but I don't want to do it unless there's a good reason.
Right, exactly.
I don't want to do it just to do it.
Yeah.
There's my blog entry, which is kind of part of, it's not future plans, but I did it on the, well, the last one that was already up last time. Or I don't know if it was up, but I had written it. I think we talked about it. It's transmitter. Anyway, next one's going to be about experiments with the transmitter.
Nice.
And we have plans to add project pages to the Island CT website. Where they're not going to be the blog or the podcast. They're going to be individual pages about a particular subject, which we'll update as we need. So that's in development.
Right.
And you got to see some of it already.
Yeah, I like the way you've set it up. It looks very nice.
Yeah, you're going to do one for the makerspace, probably?
Right.
So do you have anything else for future plans?
So hopefully the next 2 weeks we'll have our grant together for the drone.
Okay.
For the students to start making.
Yeah, you've
the
been
drone.
Talking about that a lot.
Yep. And so hopefully that'll all come together. It's one of these projects that the students have designed, have set up what and decided on what design they will go with, and they've chosen a design that they've researched on the internet as I bite my nails and think, ooh, I hope this design really works. And we have a few fathers thinking that it's a wonderful, you know, design and that. And it'll be I really hope it goes together easily for them.
Yeah.
And I think that they may have the support they need to get something up and running. And so that was exciting, you know. And I'm happy to see them be able to finish their project. So hopefully we'll be able to get it done before the end of the year. That's my only concern. But it'll be interesting.
And maybe we'll do a bit of work on open orienteering.
Yeah.
In the next 3 weeks?
Yeah, so open orienteering, definitely. Patrick has been a trooper. He's been taking over all of Falls Lake for this one.
Yep.
And hopefully that will all go smoothly for you.
Yep. We'll see how it goes tomorrow.
Yeah. And we have Osh Park boards in. And I have to tell you, so Patrick this morning is like, I wonder when my boards will come back. When is Chinese New Year? When is Chinese New Year? And I was like, a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. But I wonder how much people get prototyped in China. Yeah. And when they can't, then go to Osh Park instead.
Oh, yeah.
So, but maybe not.
I thought it was a great, you know, a great connection because we've heard about it.
It's probably not, though.
Yeah. Well, who knows? We've heard, like, technology-wise, if you order something from China during their Chinese year,
you don't want to do that.
It's probably not a good month.
It's not going to happen.
To do it. And so it's probably like in the States, you know, around December through January when people are doing their festive times for different groups. So, anyway.
Is that it?
Yep, I think that's everything.
Well, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
And make sure to check out our blog. It's up to date.
It's up to date. And soon our project pages.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.